This is Audible.
Picking Cotton, Our Memoir of Injustice and Redemption by Jennifer Thompson Canino and Ronald Cotton with Aaron Tornio. Narrated by Karen White and Richard Allen. Copyright 2009 by Jennifer Thompson Canino, Ronald Cotton, and Aaron Tornio. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with St. Martin's Press and was produced in the year 2009 by Tantor Media Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Prologue. September 2006. Ronald Cotton stands a few rows behind Jennifer Thompson Canino, watching as she cranes her head through the crowd, looking for him among the faces of the parents who have come out to watch their children play soccer. All of the fields at Northeast Park in Gibsonville, North Carolina, are occupied on this bright autumn afternoon. It's tournament day, with a parking lot crammed full of yellow school buses, SUVs, and station wagons to prove it. "Where are you?" she says into her cell phone, unable to find him. "I'm right here," Ron says, enjoying the joke. Then he reaches out and touches Jennifer's arm, causing her to turn and jump. "It's so good to see you," she says, laughing and moving close to embrace him. "You'd think I would have spotted you." Wearing a blue baseball hat, Ron, at 6'4", towers over her. He's got to lean way down to hug Jennifer, a tiny blonde with bobbed hair. The sun catches the sterling medallion he always wears around his neck, an eagle in flight. Ron immediately gets into the game. "Come on, don't let them take that ball," he shouts, clapping his hands. Beside him, Raven, his 9-year-old daughter in neat braids he helped do that morning, shoots him a look.
"Daddy!"
"What? Am I embarrassing you?" She nods, which only makes Ron yell louder.
"Let's go!"
He is cheering on Jennifer's 16-year-old daughter, Brittany, who plays center midfield, the link between offense and defense. Her brown ponytail bopping behind her, she keeps her cleats close to the ball, switchbacking across the field to try to keep it away from the other side until she's got a clear path to pass it to her fellow players. When she sees her opening, Brittany makes a strong, sure kick and sends the ball to her teammate, who takes off for the goal. The crowd yells for the black and white ball to make it into the net as if nothing could matter more. The Reds, Brittany's team, win the first game of the tournament, and then they break for lunch. Brittany, spotting Ron and Raven with her mom, jogs over and hugs them both, happy they are there. The four of them head over with the other parents to the park's pavilion. With his Burger King bags picked up from the drive-in, Ron isn't part of the usual soccer parent crowd. Moms like Jennifer, who unpack neatly prepared sandwiches and snacks from Tupperware and coolers. After the kids eat, Brittany heads off to the grass to show Raven how to kick straight and dribble, while Jennifer and Ron catch up. One nosy mom can't resist and comes over to say hello.
"Jennifer, Brittany was just great today," she says. "Too bad your husband missed it. Where is he?"
"He's with my son, doing guy stuff, but they should be here any minute," says Jennifer.
The mother's eyes dart over to Ron and back to Jennifer. She can't figure it out.
"So how do y'all know each other?" the mom says, motioning to Ron.
Jennifer and Ron look at each other, smiling. They let the moment settle between them, hanging in the air like the sweet green smell of freshly cut grass, ready for hordes of high school girls to trample it.
"We go way back," Ron says, in his characteristic way of understating things.
What they don't say is that 22 years ago, Jennifer sat in a jailhouse just 5 miles down the interstate, looked at 7 black men standing in front of her, and picked Ronald Cotton as the man who had brutally raped her 11 days before. Part 1. Jennifer. Chapter 1. I used to walk 3 miles to campus and back every day from my apartment in Burlington. There weren't any sidewalks on West Front Street, so during the summer I hugged the edge of the road, trying to stay in the patches of shade when the magnolia trees provided them.
I didn't know many people in my neighborhood, although I passed their houses and proud lawns every day. I don't know if I ever even noticed the brick home with white trim just beyond my apartment complex, but on the night that I ran through the damp grass, wearing only a blanket, it was that door I pounded on. On my way to school, my head was always buried in index cards. I had stacks and stacks of them, careful notes, all hole-punched and ring-bound, a different ring for every class. Just across from campus was a Hardee's, where I'd stop and get a coffee, then sit outside and keep studying. I didn't look over my shoulder or pay too much attention. My focus was on what lay ahead. I was going to graduate in the fall with a perfect 4.0, and my boyfriend Paul and I were talking about getting married. He was in his first year of business school at UNC Chapel Hill. That's all my life was really about, college and my boyfriend. I was 22 years old, and those were the kind of crystal-clear pictures I carried in my mind. One night, coming home in the dark, it must have been the beginning of July, I noticed a small orange glow as I was walking up to my door. It was just a pinprick of light cutting through the branches, the dry burn caught in the back of my throat. In the tree across from my bedroom window, someone was smoking a cigarette. I couldn't see who it was, but someone was there. I told myself it must be a kid, someone who had climbed up the tree to sneak a smoke. I gave it no further thought. But that's the picture that flashed in my mind afterward, a snapshot uncovered by my brain as it was reeling for answers to what happened later that month, July 1984. Burlington, North Carolina, is like most college towns. It swells during the school year with kids from Elon College and contracts during the summer, when many of them return to their hometowns, to their parents, to the summer jobs they've had since they were in high school. I'd decided to stay that summer because I was taking classes and because Paul was from Burlington and would be home for the summer break from his classes in Chapel Hill. His parents ran a barbecue place in downtown, or what was left of it. Already, the little mom-and-pop stores were emptying out or moving closer to the newly built mall near Huffman Mill Road, right off of I-40. But people still came to J.J.'s barbecue no matter what. They came for the vinegared pork and sweet tea that were as much a part of the Burlington summer as the humidity. Most days I taught aerobics at Spa Lady, and on Saturdays, when I finished teaching, I would stay to lift some weights and put in a few hours at the sales desk. That Saturday was no different. When I got off, Paul and I spent the afternoon together, browsing at a shopping mall and eating lunch nearby until the heat finally got to us. We ended up back at my apartment, napping in the comfort of the air conditioning. In the early evening, it cooled off enough for us to play tennis at the Alamance County Country Club, where he and his family were members. We were famished when we finished our showers, so we headed over to China Inn Restaurant, a favorite of ours. It was one of those all-you-can-eat deals, and I loaded up on fried rice, spring rolls, and refill after refill of sweet iced tea. I'm sure all the MSG had something to do with it. By the time we got to his friend's party, a fierce headache was blooming behind my eyes. We didn't stay very long. Back at my apartment, we turned up the AC unit in the den full blast. Paul came into my room carrying a glass of water and some aspirin. I fell asleep to his rubbing my back. The police report would later indicate that he slipped out around 11 p.m., taking care not to wake me. Around 3 a.m., something pulled me from sleep, the sound of feet shuffling. At the twilight edge of consciousness, I searched the dim borders between sleep and wakefulness. Was it a noise from my dream? A nightmare? Or something outside my head? All I heard was the thrum and rattle of the air conditioner against the metal frame of the window. My weighted eyelids closed and sank me right back into sleep. Something grazed my arm. I opened my eyes and felt my heart hammering through my chest. Everything was still and quiet, save for the percussion of blood in my ears, the rush of my breath. My body was terrified, although my mind hadn't caught up yet. I struggled to focus my eyes in the fuzzy dark of my room. Instinctively, I pulled the sheets up around my neck.
I began to make out the contours of my white dresser, my Smurfette doll, the pale blue and peach knick-knacks my mom and I had cheerily decorated the apartment with when I'd moved in the previous fall. By the side of my bed, as I made out an unfamiliar roundness, a stab of pure panic hit my gut. It was the top of someone's head. Somebody was crouching by my right side. "Who is that? Who's there?" I said, allowing myself to think it must be Paul or someone playing a stupid joke. A man sprang up and was on me in seconds. I heard myself scream. Something cold, flat, and metallic pressed into my neck. My mind snapped awake. "Shut up or I'll cut you," he hissed, clamping a gloved hand down over my mouth. His breath was inches from my own, and it reeked like an old ashtray someone had spilled beer all over. "Can't breathe," I tried to say, my words muffled by the rough material of his glove. He moved his hand away from my mouth and used it to pin my arms back over my head. "Scream and I'll kill you," he said, pushing the point of the blade harder into my neck with his other hand. My first thought was that he was robbing me and that when I woke up I'd startled him. I told him he didn't have to hurt me. I would give him my credit cards, my car keys. I would not call the police. "My wallet is in the den," I offered, my voice strangled and small from the lack of air in my constricted chest. "Take all my money." I squirmed under him, but he was too heavy, the lamp on my night table too far out of my reach. Without anything to use as a weapon, I had little to help me fight back. I was certain that even if I freed my hands, the best I could do was slap him before he stabbed me. I couldn't kick him because he was sitting on my legs. At 5'2", I knew I wouldn't win a physical struggle. There, in my memory, at the knife edge of fear, time distorted. Some moments hurtled by, others seeped by slowly, as if they were becoming one with everything I was ever going to be. In this particular moment, he sneered at me. "I got your $10, he said, "but I don't want your fucking money." He reached down, yanked the sheet away from me, and pulled off my purple underwear. The definitiveness of that knowledge, that I was going to be raped, settled on me like his weight, crushing me. Was this how I was going to die? Was this the last thing I would see? My head ran its own track of protest while my body lay there, unable to move. "I don't want to die. I want to live. I want to see my mom and dad again. Paul." "Just relax. It's been a long time for you, hasn't it, baby?" He put his head down between my legs. The intimacy of this gesture revolted me. My body went rigid, an unconscious resistance all the way down to the muscle. "Don't touch me." The Chinese food I'd eaten with Paul churned in my stomach. Was it only a few hours ago that we'd sat at China Inn? My disbelief was a kind of vertigo, and I clutched dumbly for anything to prove that this wasn't really happening. But those hours were already part of something else that seemed to drift further and further out of reach. Before, a perpetual yesterday before this night ripped a hole in my life that I tumbled into, bottomless and dark. I swallowed back my nausea, grateful that all I had drunk at dinner was iced tea. It seemed vital that my mind was clear because I was imploring it to figure out what to do. Think. Think. My mind wanted to leave, to dull the sensate horror of his hands and mouth on me, but I knew I must stay present if I was going to have any chance of staying alive.
"Your man's overseas in Germany, ain't he?"
He was wrong. It was my brother Joe who was backpacking over there, but I didn't bother to correct him. He took my stunned silence for what it was, interpreted it.
"I know all about you, Jennifer. You from Winston-Salem. They burned witches there, ain't that right?" he said. "Yeah, you a witch. We gonna have a good time tonight."
Again, I didn't correct him, but I registered that he wasn't as smart as he thought. In school, we had studied the Salem witch trials in Massachusetts, and I never forgot Giles Corey, the only man in American history ever pressed to death. To force him to talk, the court had placed a board upon his chest and piled on stone after stone. His last words were, "More weight," before his lungs collapsed and his ribcage snapped all around him. My bones didn't give way. I was alive and breathing, alert to the sounds of his unzipping and kicking off his shoes and my silent dread of anticipating what was next. I smelled the scent of cigarette smoke all over him, and then he was inside me, his face just above mine. He told me he knew I wore glasses, so he thought I couldn't see him. He was wrong again. My glasses were for distance. Everything right in front of me, I could see. Light from the parking lot lamppost filtered through the blinds. It wasn't a lot, but it was enough. In blinks, I willed myself to note the details. I studied his face for features to identify. The hairline, his awful mouth. Did he have scars, tattoos? He had close-cropped hair. Although I didn't want to look at him, I had to. How much could I bear? I tried to look in his eyes. They were distinctly almond-shaped, small, and set deep into his face. I searched for something human to connect to, some kind of appeal I could make through eye contact. But he kept shifting his dark gaze from my eyes. He had high, broad cheekbones, and his mouth was not overly large. A faint shadow of hair framed his upper lip. It looked more like dirt than a mustache. He kept talking to me, telling me I probably never had a man like him. It was sick what he did, as if we were lovers meeting surreptitiously in the middle of the night, as if this was some kind of fantasy. I was never so enraged and frightened at the same time. My hands balled up into fists. I couldn't stop the fight in them, useless as they were under him. I thought if I could just keep him talking, if I could win his trust, maybe I could get him to put his weapon down. Maybe I could figure out a way to run. I was trying to learn anything about where he lived, or went to school, or how old he was, any clue to who this monster in the dark was. The only way I could fight him was to outsmart him. "I'm afraid of knives," I told him. "I can't relax until you put it down. Can you put it outside, on my car?" I lied, but it was all a twisted lie anyway. His kissing me, talking to me, like it was a game we were playing together. I could sense his giving in. He stopped and looked at me. "You ain't gonna call the police?" Here it was, my will staking a claim, this first tiny victory giving way to a hope that maybe I would survive the night. "No. Just drop it outside on my car. Please. I can't relax." I used his words. He didn't get angrier. If he did this, I thought, I could shut the door behind him fast. It'll give me enough time to call 911. I had no way of knowing that the phone lines had already been cut. He began to get off me. He reached for his shoes on the floor, the ones he'd removed as he got on me, punctuating the moment with a thud. They were black canvas shoes. He moved slowly, testing me, unsure. I didn't feel powerful, but we were at least negotiating now. His uncertainty about what I was going to do reminded me that he hadn't taken everything from me. "I have to pee," I announced. I wasn't asking for his permission. I headed out to the hallway toward the bathroom. "First, I have to watch you go outside so I know you really went. While you're out there, I'll go to the bathroom." I grabbed the soft stadium blanket and wrapped it around me. Henny, our housekeeper, my second mother, gave this to me, the red, yellow, and blue plaid that I was hoping, wishing, and praying would keep him from touching me again. I trembled with fear, and he accepted it was because I was cold. But the blanket was a deliberate choice. I wasn't wearing any clothes, but that wasn't going to stop me from running if I got a chance. Once in the bathroom, I turned on the light, getting another glimpse of his face. "Turn it off!" he yelled, retreating like a wounded animal into the shadows. I closed the door and ran the water. The bathroom window was too small for me to climb out. If he came after me in here, I'd be trapped. I rushed out into the hallway. There was a nightlight in the den, breaking up the inky corners of the hallway. My eyes continued to adjust to the dark, giving me more detail on him. Standing next to him for a few minutes, I tried to record information about how tall he was, if he walked pigeon-toed or duck-footed. Based on my height, I figured he must be about 6 feet tall. As he inched his way toward the front door, he didn't take his eyes off me.
"You gonna let me back in, right?"
I reassured him, did my best to sound natural, but I frantically wondered if I could be fast enough to get to the front door before he came back in. It was a chance I'd have to take. I heard the knife hit the table on the porch, his frame still in the doorway. He never even stepped outside. In an instant, he shut and locked the front door. I remained in the hallway, moving toward the den, anything to keep from going back into the bedroom with him. I needed a new plan.
"Turn on the stereo," he commanded.
I walked into the living room, and I saw my postcards and pictures scattered all over the coffee table. I hit the power button on the radio, the DJ's voice on Kiss coming through the speakers. I needed to get to the back door. Maybe it was open. "I'm thirsty. I'm gonna get a drink. You want something?" Another stalling tactic I hoped would buy me some time. He fiddled with the dial, and the blue LCD light illuminated his profile as he trolled for a station. He didn't have a wide nose.
"Yeah, fix me something with Seagram's and let's make it a party."
Then he held up something.
"Can I have this?" he said.
It was a picture of me, standing in a bathing suit at Apex Lake. Why he asked me this still baffles me, since permission was so beside the point. I nodded, and he put it in his back pocket. I headed into the kitchen. If I survived, I told myself, I would tell the police he was a light-skinned black man wearing dark khakis, a blue shirt with white stripes on the sleeve, and canvas boat shoes. He wore white knit gloves on his hands. I still had the fibrous taste of them in my mouth. I flipped on the light switch because I knew it would protect me. It was a small buffer zone. He wouldn't come too close to me with the light on. On the table, I saw a pack of Vantage cigarettes from my purse, empty Coors cans, my wallet with my license out. How long was he here while I slept? Maybe only 15 feet were between us, but he was behind a corner, just out of sight. I turned on the faucet. The water hitting the basin made a loud, tinny sound. I opened the cupboards, clanked glasses together, threw ice cubes in the sink. I zeroed in on the door in my kitchen. His way in was my only way out. I heard his voice coming toward the kitchen.
"Is that door locked?" he yelled.
"Run!" I set out in my backyard. It was misting rain, and the grass was wet and cool under my feet. I headed immediately to the right, the next unit. I banged on my neighbor's back door, screaming. But there was no time to waste, no time for someone sleeping to hear me get out of bed and open the door. He was already coming out my door. I ran across the yard to the next building. I didn't have any plan other than to run. He was somewhere behind me in pursuit, but the soft, damp ground absorbed the sound of his and my footsteps. A tree branch whipped me in the face, and I staggered into a corner between two buildings that connected in an L shape, a place that had no escape if he found me. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw a light on, in a brick house with a carport. I hopped the low dog fence that separated that property from the apartment complex and slammed my hands on the screen door, frantically hitting the doorbell. I knew my stalker could see me in the light. "Please open. Please open." A man inside the house saw me through the window of the door.
"Help me, please. I've been raped by a black man. He's after me," I yelled.
The man screamed. Behind him, his wife appeared.
"She's a student at the college."
"I recognize her. Let her in." As their door locked behind me, I fainted. Everything went black as I saw the terror in this man's eyes of what the night had brought him, this hysterical girl, naked except for a blanket. When I came to, I heard them calling 911. All the lights were off, but we could see my rapist circling the house. The man who let me in stood by the door with a baseball bat. Here is where there are moments lost forever down in that black hole, gaps of time I must have lived through but have no recollection of. The moments that remain are fragments, hard, sharp fragments. Somehow I was then in the back of an ambulance. I heard the sirens and the bloodhounds, the drag of the windshield wipers back and forth across the glass, clearing the fine coating of rain. At Memorial Hospital, when I was told to undress, I realized that I was not wearing my own clothes. The plaid blanket was gone. I now wore green athletic shorts, someone else's underwear, and a T-shirt. The people who had let me in must have given me some of their teenage daughter's clothing. I was aware of the material touching my body, only it no longer felt like my body. I was no longer me. The girl in my mind, the picture-perfect student who would be getting married soon to Paul, was sucked down by that black hole, too. The doctor was called in, sleep still in his eyes. He didn't look too happy about being awakened in the middle of the night, and it was clearly my fault. He was sloppy and unsympathetic. I didn't want him to touch me. I felt like a dead girl, watching another strange man plumb my body, humiliate it. Saliva swabs, vaginal swabs, pubic hair combings. My body as evidence, as the crime scene. I wished I could take off my skin and have them seal it away in a plastic bag. In only a medical gown, I lay on a bed with privacy curtains in the ER. Uniformed police officers were nearby. I heard their radios. The curtain slid on their metal track, and a plainclothes police officer walked in. "Miss Thompson," he said, "I'm Detective Mike Golden." His was the first compassionate face I saw, despite the fact that he didn't look like he could be much older than I was. Detective Golden explained procedure to me, going to the station to make a statement, the rape crisis counselor who would be available to me. He wanted to know what family he should call, and I told him Paul and my sister Janet. As he talked, I heard another woman crying somewhere in the ER. "What happened to her?" I asked, nodding in the direction of the sound. He paused for a minute before saying, "She was raped. We think it's the same guy." I began to cry again, for her, for both of us. This must have been the first moment I felt the hate. I hated him for what he had done to us. He's not going to get away with this. "Miss Thompson, did you get a good look at your assailant?" Detective Golden asked. "Do you think you'd recognize him if you saw him again?" In an instant, it was all there. "Shut up, or I'll cut you." His narrow eyes, the pencil-thin mustache, the repulsive lips, the nose so close to my own. His laughter after he asked me if I wanted my $10 back, and I said, "You stole my money?" "Yes," I told the detective, "I would." Paul drove me to the police station, following the detective. I collapsed in his arms when I saw him, feeling like I never wanted to leave that space. We didn't really talk. He was rumpled and quiet. It was a lot for a 25-year-old guy to take in, especially one like Paul, who had his whole life mapped out. The last bit of night was leaving the sky, and as the sunrise began to bleach it, I felt filthy and exhausted. The smell of my rapist lingered in my nostrils. It was all over me, and I wondered if Paul could smell him, too. Already the gulf between us was so much more than this too early morning silence. It was a fault line. I walked into the building. It was the first time I had ever been in a police station. My younger sister Janet and her boyfriend Andrew were already there. Janet was blonde and brown-eyed like me, but she was taller and thinner, with a longer face and a wide, easy smile. Andrew was somewhat stocky. His dark Irish looks always reminded me of a young Al Pacino. I clung to Janet for a long time. The police called my parents. They must have reached my father at home in Winston-Salem. My mother was staying at our vacation place, a condo at Grandfather Mountain, because it was near Appalachian State University, where she was taking classes. I remember Janet speaking to them on the phone, looking at me and telling them, "Yes, physically, she's okay." My hand went to the side of the neck where he'd pressed the knife in. I took the phone. "Raped? Last night? Police?" I heard my voice saying these words, those exacting words cutting through the surreal fog, coating everything. "Oh, Jennifer," my mother said sadly. Then, "Do you think it was someone who saw you in your leotard at Spa Lady?" I withdrew deeper into the numb composure that kept me functioning. I told her I had to go and that I would call soon. Fatigue gripped every part of me, but I fought to remain present, to do what I had to do. I was led into a conference room where some officers set up a recorder and a small microphone in front of me. Detective Galdon asked if I wanted Paul to remain in the room while I made my statement. I didn't want Paul to hear any of it, but I knew he would have to know, and it was easier to have him there in the room than have to tell him separately. The record button engaged, and a plastic click set the tape in motion. Facing the microphone, the detectives began to question me. The small wheels spun the tape forward, and I had no choice but to proceed. Detective Galdon had kind eyes, and I tried to look at them as I relayed the memories of last night that felt carved onto me, like scars I'd never be able to cover. I couldn't bear to look at Paul in the corner. It was mid-morning when we began the composite sketch. I was grateful for the task and the focus it required. Detective Galdon brought in an identikit, a blank canvas on which we would create the face of my rapist. It seemed like the worst kind of irony. All you want to do is forget, but instead, in the fluorescent glare of a conference room, they ask you to remember over and over and over. I looked at pages and pages of eyes, ears, noses, chins. The parts swam in my field of vision, forcing me to linger over the eyes of my rapist, become an expert in the shape of his brows, which were seared in my memory. When Paul and I first met, in those early bursting moments of infatuation, I would constantly try to recall every part of his face. But I had a vague imprint of him then. I found that I could not isolate his eyes or his smile very well. Only later would I know every scar and crease, the exact shade of his eyes, the features I had grown to love, the features I studied up close in the quiet moments we spent together. After an hour and a half, we had a face. The mouth wasn't quite right, and the ears stuck out too much, but it was close to the picture in my mind. The police were happy. The other victim wasn't sure she could identify him, so I was determined to do a good job. Around noon, the police department released the composite to the local news. Detective Galdon wanted me to return to my apartment with them so I could let them know if there was anything that looked out of place, something that they might have missed. But before I could even convey the terror I felt about stepping back inside my apartment, uniformed officers interrupted. Something was incomplete. Detective Galdon looked frustrated but softened when he spoke to me. "Did you get a penicillin shot?" "I don't think so," I told him.
"The morning after pill?"
I shook my head.
"Miss Thompson, I'm very sorry about this, but we need to get you back to the hospital. We're going to take you to Alamance County Hospital this time, see if they can't do a better job."
I could tell he was sorry he had to put me through this. Another hospital, another rape kit. There was the biology of the crime to deal with, marks that may have been left not just in my shattered psyche and my nightmares, but in the flesh that he'd crawled inside. If there had been any food in me, I would have thrown it all up. Afterward, Paul drove me back to the apartment, following the police. We turn down Roslyn Drive and into the parking lot in front of the Brookwood Garden Apartments, my building with its pleasant gray brick and blue shuttered facade coming into view. Did I miss a sign? In the single-story structure before me, divided neatly into apartment units, was there a warning that it wasn't safe? I had lived in another building in this complex only the year before, with a roommate, but I was so excited to be on my own. I wanted to live by myself, to be independent. Now I wondered if I was ever going to be able to be alone again. I knew at least that I would never be in this apartment alone again. The scene had already been processed, Detective Golden explained, but coming back in the daylight might give them another chance to collect evidence. I went in, surrounded by police officers. The linens were gone from my bed. Smurfette had been bagged as evidence. Light pushed through the corners of the blinds, still shut as if it was night, and afternoon sun from the unshaded windows filled the rest of the apartment. Gone were the grainy shadows, the treacherous, unlit pockets that he had hidden in the night before. Detective Golden asked me to let him know if anything looked disturbed, but as we moved through the rooms, I lingered over everything, saying goodbye. This was no longer my home. Outside my back door, the policeman showed me the broken light, the three jabs into the frame, probably made by his knife. It didn't appear to be enough damage to get the door open, the officers explained, pointing out that the door was swollen. I've had trouble with it in the past few weeks, I told them. It's hard to close because it's not fitting snugly into the frame. It was probably easy for him to pry it open, the officers said. I showed them the postcards and letters strewn across the coffee table in the den, things that had been neatly piled up, things that he had gone through and read while I'd slept in the next room. Golden put them into a bag to dust for latent fingerprints and then picked up something from the hallway just outside the den. "Do you recognize this?" he said, holding a small piece of dark foam rubber. I looked at it. I was, and still am, a meticulous housekeeper. There was no way I would have left something like this on the floor. "No," I told him. "That couldn't have been there before. I would have noticed it." He nodded and placed it into an evidence bag. Later, this would become key evidence. The prosecutor would hold it up in court and say it had come from the soles of the shoes my attacker had worn. "Ready to go?" Golden said. I nodded before it hit me. Where was I going to go? Paul took me to his parents' house, where I finally showered and thought about how I was going to sleep. I was almost embarrassed to face his mother, as if she knew something private about me she wasn't supposed to know. She looked equally displeased with the knowledge, as if it was a secret she wished I had kept. I wondered if being raped by a black man made me a less desirable prospective wife for her son. My sister and her boyfriend were invited to spend the night, but Paul's mother refused to let Paul and me stay in the same room. "It wouldn't look right," I overheard her whisper. I wanted to shout, "Don't worry, I have no intention of having sex the night after I've been raped," but I couldn't marshal the energy. Instead, I was shown to his sister's room, which had three single beds in it. Paul rigged the door with string and pie tins, a Boy Scout heroic booby trap that would alert me if anyone tried to enter while I slept. Janet took the bed next to mine, and I got into bed, letting the mattress underneath me accept all of my weight. I tried to give in to the pull of weariness, the sleep my body so desperately craved. But every time I closed my eyes, I heard things. No sooner would I start to drift when suddenly I would bolt upright, sobbing. Eventually, Janet just got on the narrow bed with me and held me. Suddenly, my younger sister was my protector. But how would I ever be safe again? Despite a foot pursuit, my attacker had escaped the police and then raped someone again, less than an hour later, less than a mile from my apartment. He knew my name, knew things about me.
Somewhere out there in the darkness, he was waiting.
Chapter 2.
There were 3 burglaries last night in West Burlington, and 2 of the burglary victims were sexually assaulted. The police are looking for a black man in his late 20s, approximately 6 feet tall, slim to medium build, neatly dressed, wearing a navy blue athletic shirt with white stripes on the sleeves, green army fatigue pants, black shoes, and possibly wearing white gloves. Suspect has a pencil-thin mustache. Police released this sketch of the suspect. If you have any information, please contact TV broadcast, July 29th, 1984. Over and over, the local news broadcasts the composite image. Radio stations WBAG, WBBB, WPCM, WQRB, and WSML ran similar requests for anyone with information to come forward. A white woman raped in her home in the middle of the night by a black man who had the audacity to outrun the police and the dogs, and then go on to rape another woman in her home, didn't sit very well with the community. A rapist was on the loose. Paul drove me to Grandfather Mountain, where my mother was staying. It was 3 hours outside of Burlington and billed itself as a sanctuary for the human spirit, which all these years later seems like a bad punchline. The condo was built into the mountain to take advantage of the Blue Ridge views. The first floor had the kitchen, a bathroom, and a bedroom with a queen-size bed. There was a split upper level, with my parents' bedroom on the first split and the last bedroom on the highest level. Sleeping up there felt like sleeping up in the air. I didn't think about it until years later, but for some reason I was put in the bedroom downstairs, which had a ground-floor window. On the night table, a big flower arrangement with a Get Well Soon card sticking out of it. I smiled awkwardly. They were my mother's attempt at grace notes, as if I had a bad flu. It was hard to fault her. There was no etiquette guidebook to tell you what to do when someone you love has been raped. When she asked me if I was all right, scanning me for damage, I answered, "I'm fine." I did this for her benefit, for Paul's, and because I didn't know just how to articulate the emotional squalls I had felt in the 2 days since my rape. It seemed to be the answer everyone wanted, including me. I guess I thought that if I acted like everything was fine, it would be. Despite everything that had happened, my mother's rules about appearances and propriety were no different than Paul's mother's. Paul was not going to stay with me in the same room. We weren't married after all, and how would that look? My mother must have had the dryer going on the other side of the bedroom wall. Clank, 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 as something thumped repeatedly against the metal cylinder, turning over and over, I thought of the ACs rattling in the window on that night, metal on metal, which had prevented me from hearing that someone had broken into my apartment. As I lay in the condo, my heart rate accelerated. He was there. Branches moved outside the window. He'd found me. Clank. Too frightened to cry, I felt like the wind had been knocked out of me. I couldn't get air. I didn't know if I could scream. Fear immobilized me. If I cried for help, he would definitely come in and kill me. But if I didn't scream for Paul or my mother, he would get me anyway. Clank. I don't know how long it took me to make a noise. I tried to get something out, but I lay there saying, "Ah, ah," the sound you make in your dream when you are screaming at the top of your lungs but barely make a whimper. But finally the volume came. I screamed and screamed. Paul and my mother came running into the room. They found me hunkered down in a ball on the floor with my arms over my head. "What's the matter?" my mother said. "There's somebody outside. He's outside the window. I can hear him." Paul went outside to look and came back, saying he had checked all around but no one was there. My mother put her arms around me, and I cried and cried. I felt like a child. She lay on the bed with me, and out of sheer exhaustion, I finally fell asleep. When I woke up late the next morning, though, she wasn't there next to me.
She knocked on my door from outside the room to say that the Burlington police were on the phone. They wanted me to come in and look at some photos. Paul and I left almost immediately.
Miss Thompson, Detective Golden is going to lay down 6 photos of black males for you to look at. The suspect may or may not be included in these. Please take your time and study each picture. If you do see the person who hurt you, show us,
said Detective Ballard Sullivan, an older officer whose hair, at least what was left of it, was dark red. Like many men who lost their hair, he seemed to make up for it by framing his face with it. A lighter auburn mustache and trim beard gave his otherwise jowly face some definition. I could tell he was the person in charge. Golden and the other detective deferred to him. He told me to call him Sully. Despite the smattering of freckles across his nose that gave him the smudged look of a 10-year-old, Sully wore his authority like a 10-gallon cowboy hat. He did not have a soft side. I figured that compassion in his line of work might have worn away over the years. Detective Golden told me not to feel compelled to make an identification, to take as long as I needed. I sat at Sully's desk while Golden dealt the mug shots like a pack of cards, 3 on top, 3 on the bottom. The detective stood behind me, and I went through each picture slowly and carefully. The stakes felt awfully high. My heart raced on adrenaline. I assumed they must have had a suspect. Why would they want me to drive all this way if they didn't? All I had to do was pick him out. And if I failed to do that, would he go free? Would he find me? Most were easily eliminated, and I narrowed it down to 2. When I looked at one photo, the image of the man performing oral sex on me came back so violently I thought I would be sick right there. The memory was too sharp and clear. "Yeah, this is the one," I said, pointing to the picture. "I think this is the guy."
"You think that's the guy?" asked Sully.
"It's him," I said, clarifying.
"You're sure?" asked Golden.
"Positive." They asked me to date and initial the back of the photo, and then they did too. "Did I do okay?" I asked. Sully and Golden looked at each other. Relief washed over me.
"You did great, Miss Thompson."
It had taken me 5 minutes. When I was young, my family called me Little Mama because I liked taking care of everyone. If my sister or one of my brothers was sick, I'd buy them coloring books and bring them juice. Now I wanted to be taken care of, but everyone was off doing his or her own thing. My brother Joe was away in Europe, which I told myself was why he didn't call. My older brother Jim was already married with his own family, living in Winston-Salem. Janet, although she did the best she could, was trying to get through college. The world didn't stop, and so I sleepwalked through my days as they blurred together. Sadie, my rape crisis counselor, had an office at Elon. I met her that first night in the hospital. She was probably in her 40s with short, curly hair and a dimpled smile. Her soothing, kindly demeanor belied toughness. When she had to be, Sadie was a fighter. She was my advocate, she explained. She would help me through the police protocol and trial, should my case make it there. "I am here for you whenever you need me," she said. But I wouldn't allow myself to be needy with her. I had a plan. The police were going to get this guy, and he was going to pay. As much as everyone wanted me to forget about it and move on, I would not do that until the man who attacked me was behind bars. Almost 2 decades later, right before Sadie retired, she told me that she remembered seeing me walking to school every day before my assault. Once, she had even stopped to offer a ride. "No, thank you," she said, I replied. "I prefer to walk," and continued in the direction I was headed.
"That was you," she recalled, "always so determined. You didn't want to deviate from your plan." Sadie met me at the police station when they brought me in to do a physical lineup. Detective Golden thought it would be a good idea for her to be there. It was August 8, 1984, 11 days after my assault. He called me the day before to say the lineup was set for 2 p.m. the next day, and that Sully, the bearded detective I had met during the photo identification, would drive me to and from the station. I sat in a chair in the detective's office with Sadie. Detective Golden came in. "How are you holding up?" he asked gently. "I'm fine," I said. I didn't want him to see me as weak or unfocused, to be worried that I couldn't do this. "Here's how it's going to work. You're going to be shown 7 black males of similar appearance. They will be standing in a line, holding a card with a number. Each of them will step forward, turn completely around to the right, say something, and step back. If after viewing all 7 you are able to say that one of them was the person who raped you, write his number on the piece of blank paper you're going to be given and hand it to me. If you don't see the man who raped you, leave the paper blank and hand it to me. If you're not sure, leave the paper blank and hand it to me. If after seeing all 7 you want any of the men to repeat the procedure, just ask me. Don't feel compelled to make an identification. Make sense?" I nodded. "All right, then. Let's go in there." Sadie and I followed him down a corridor to a basement room. I'd only seen stuff like this on TV, where you stood behind a wall with a window in it. Nothing could have prepared me for what I walked into. I stiffened and tried to suck in air with an audible gasp. There were 7 black men lined up against the wall. All that separated them from me was a conference room table. They could see me. Later, I learned that this had been a transitional building. A new Burlington police station was being built near the railroad tracks. But at that moment, I figured that's the way lineups were really done, that TV had gotten it wrong.
"It's okay. I will be right here. Nothing can hurt you," said Golden.
Sadie and I stood behind the table. There were maybe 6 feet between me and the lineup. There were other officers in the room and some other men I didn't recognize. "Breathe, breathe," I told myself. I didn't want to pass out, but I was sick with fear. If he was here, now he knew what I looked like in broad daylight. He knew my name. If he was here, I couldn't screw this up. Starting with the man holding a card that read 1, each stepped forward, closer to the table, turned to the side, then back to the front, and spoke.
"Shut up or I'll cut you. Hey, baby, how you doing? Your man's over in Germany. It's been a long time."
The words hit me like a punch to the stomach. Hearing what that man had uttered to me, his face right above mine, I had to make my mind split the way it had that night. I didn't want to make eye contact with any of them, despite trying to look at each of them closely. I concentrated on my job, to find him if he was here, even though my mind vividly replayed scenes as each man repeated the lines. Number 4 began his turn. He had on a light yellow shirt and jeans. A shudder of recognition went through me. Was this him? Number 5 went next. When he said, "Shut up or I'll kill you," I froze. He and number 4 looked so much alike, so much like my attacker. Why did he say, "I'll kill you," I wondered. Was it a trick? He had on a brown and beige mock turtleneck shirt and jeans. The rest of the men finished. I kept looking at numbers 4 and 5. I turned to Detective Golden. "It's between 4 and 5. Can I see them again?" I whispered. Number 4 repeated the procedure. His facial features were so close, but his body didn't seem right. My rapist had been lankier.
"Shut up or I'll cut you."
Number 5 got it right this time. I looked at his face. He had a light mustache. His eyes looked cold. His body was long and lean. He knew to wear brown, I thought, because he knew he had been wearing dark blue the night of my assault, and he knew to wear his hair differently. It was him. There was no doubt in my mind. I knew it. If I didn't get him, he was going to come after me. The terror simply took my breath away. He was standing right in front of me, and if the police didn't lock him up, surely he would walk out of there, find me, and finish the job. The next time, I was certain I would not get away. He would kill me. I wrote 5 on the piece of paper in front of me and slid it over to Detective Galdon. He nodded and showed it to a few other men in the room. Then they led me back out into the hallway. As always, I wanted to know how I had done.
"We thought that might be the guy," said Galdon. "It's the same person you picked from the photos."
My knees nearly gave out from under me. We got him. Sadie squeezed my hand, proud of me. There were so many others who never even got this far, she told me, so many who would never tell anyone what had happened to them, much less seek prosecution. With Joe off in Europe, my family worked it out so I could stay at his place in Chapel Hill, since there was no way I was going back to Brookwood Gardens. Being in Chapel Hill meant I would be closer to Paul, who would be returning to graduate school there after the summer at home with his parents. He and Janet and Andrew packed up my stuff and moved me. I resumed my classes at Elon, driving to Burlington every day, trying to keep myself occupied. If I was busy, I could fake it okay, but if I was by myself, the events of that night would constantly run through my head. My move to Chapel Hill put a tremendous burden on Paul. I now needed him desperately. Looking back, I know I must have suffocated him. Chapel Hill had been his refuge, and I invaded it. He couldn't get back to his schoolwork or his friends without my resentment. He was 25 years old, and the next 2 years of business school would be hard to get through if he was constantly tending to me. One evening, we were at his apartment. He had some friends over, and they were watching Risky Business. It suddenly became very threatening, the sexual content of the movie, the way women were portrayed. It felt personal. I went into the kitchen with Paul as he got more beers. "Can you tell them to turn it off?" I asked him. I can't watch it." He kissed the top of my head and walked back out into the den.
"Guys, can you turn that off? It's making Jennifer uncomfortable."
I listened from the kitchen.
"She's just gonna have to get over it, man."
The movie stayed on, and I went into Paul's bedroom alone. Janet made a promise to my parents that she would be there for me, and she was, but she had her classes at Elon and her boyfriend, and I urged her to return to them. "I'm fine," I told her. "After all, people told me all the time that I was lucky."
"Did he beat you?" they asked. "Cut you?"
When I shook my head no, they shrugged. They were sorry it happened to me, but it just didn't seem like that big a deal because it was just sex. Janet was bigger than me, a whole 4 inches taller, so even though she was my younger sister, she acted as if she were the older one. She always had this tough act about her. Several months before, Janet and I had taken a walk near my apartment, winding up near a lake on campus populated by ducks. We'd been walking for maybe an hour or so, and the conversation wandered from one thing to another.